for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Charlie Brown was a farm boy from West Virginia. Franz Stigler was a former German airline pilot from Bavaria. 69 years ago today, as fighter pilots in World War II, the two men met over the wartime skies of Germany. Their encounter as enemies resulted in a friendship that would last until their deaths. Author and journalist Adam Makos recounts the story in his new book, A Higher Call, an incredible true story of combat and chivalry in the war-torn skies of World War II. Adam Makos joins me in this studio. We'll take your calls throughout the hour. 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Diane.
It's good to have you here, Adam. I know you grew up fascinated by World War II and stories of the Greatest Generation. Where did all that come from? You're a young man.
Yes, I'm 31, actually. My grandfathers, when I was growing up, both had served in the World War II era. One was in the Pacific, one was a Marine stateside. And I was lucky. They took an interest in me. And so we would travel to air shows together, to World War II museums. And they planted that seed of interest in that black and white era of theirs. And I just took to it and was enamored.
And how did you come on the story of Charlie Brown and Franz Stigler?
I had been working for a small aviation magazine that I founded with my brother and best friend back in high school. So we would interview veterans from down the street. We'd interview veterans from across the country. And they all kept whispering and hinting and speaking of this legendary story from the war. And they said, "Did you ever hear of the German who let the American bomber escape?" And I hadn't. And I said, "Well, I haven't, but I'm going to look into this." And that's when I began looking for this man named Charlie Brown.
How long did it take for you to find him?
It didn't take too long to find Charlie. But when I found him, he really shocked me, threw me for a loop. I said, "Mr. Brown, could I do an interview with you?" I sent him a magazine and I sent him a letter. And when we were on the phone, he said, "Adam, I'd love to give you an interview, but I have to stop you there. If you want this story, if you really believe in this story, you're not going to talk to me first." He said, "You're going to go talk to Franz Stigler, my older brother. In this story, I'm just a character. Franz Stigler is the hero."
That's very interesting. Now that you've set this up for us, why don't you read from the book telling what happened?
Okay. All right, I'll muster my best Edward Murrow voice, which I don't have. Okay, so this is from the center of the book. This is the crux of the story, A Higher Call. It's about Franz Stigler, this hero that Charlie Brown spoke of. Franz had seen planes come back from battle shot to pieces, but he had never seen anything like this. Every foot of the bomber's metal had silver holes where the bullets had entered and flaked away the paint. Franz became entranced with wonder. Kicking his rudder pedal and nudging the throttle forward a bit, he swung his 109 past the tail and flew along the bomber's right side, parallel to the fuselage. Franz scanned the craft for guns and saw that the bomber's crew was not turning them on him. He saw that the waist gun was missing, blasted from its mount. He saw that the top turret was empty and that the radio room had been blown apart. He flew just high enough that he was beyond the elevation of the ball turret. Then, alongside the bomber, Franz saw something troubling. Exploding shells had stripped away its skin in the waist. Through the plane's exposed ribs, he saw its crew, huddled over one another, caring for their wounded. Moving forward, Franz settled his 109 into position above the bomber's right wingtip. He could see that the bomber's nose was blown away. The plane flew as if held up by an invisible string. What now, Franz thought. Suddenly, movement beneath the bomber drew his eyes. Franz watched as the ball turret gunner swiveled his guns toward him. "You'd shoot me if you could," Franz thought. He knew the turret lacked the elevation to aim at him. From his turret, Blackie, the gunner, looked in shock at the 109 pilot. A minute before, Blackie had prepared to die, expecting the 109 pilot to shoot him from the sky after he had disappeared from behind the tail. But the pilot had never fired. Instead, the German fighter pilot now flew formation with the American bomber. Blackie abandoned his efforts to clear his guns. Instead, he folded his hands. "What are you waiting for?" Blackie said quietly as the German's eyes met his. The Franz Stiegler who went to Africa to avenge his brother's death would have had an answer. He would have destroyed the bomber and killed its crew. But there in the desert and over ancient Sicily, the last of Europe's knights had taught Franz Stiegler a new code. Their code said to fight with fearlessness and restraint, to celebrate victories, not death, and to know when it was time to answer a higher call. Franz gazed at the men in the waist, tending to one another's wounds. He looked into the ashen face of the ball turret gunner. He thought about what his brother August would have done. A gear clicked in Franz's soul. He laid a hand over the pocket of his jacket and felt his rosary beads within. "This will be no victory for me," Franz decided. "I will not have this on my conscience for the rest of my life." Franz saw the coast a few miles ahead. There he knew alarms were blaring and soldiers were running to their guns. Any second, explosions would ring out, showering the bomber in a rain of steel. Franz had chosen to spare the bomber's crew from his own guns, a gesture that would have been enough for most men. But Franz decided he would try something more. Looking along the wing and into the cockpit, he saw the co-pilot was absent. Through the shadows, he saw the pilot in the left seat, his hands gripping the controls. Franz waved, trying to get the pilot's attention, but the man stared straight ahead. Franz remained on the bomber's wing, the machine's laboring engines drowning out his 109's purr. He wanted to shout to the pilot, to tell him that time was running out.
An extraordinary story, and what Franz finally does to allow Charlie Brown, who is the pilot, to know that he's going to do everything he can to guide the plane to safety is to salute.
It's a gesture that shocks Charlie, and Charlie doesn't reply in kind. He closes his eyes and shakes his head when he sees this German on his wing. Then when he sees the man relaxed, calm, smiling, nodding, saluting him, Charlie doesn't salute back, because he thinks that this German pilot is toying with him. He's going to shoot him down over the water. He's going to shoot him down at any minute. He doesn't realize that this German pilot, Franz Stiegler, has decided to, in essence, betray his own country and escort the American plane out of German airspace.
And how does he do that?
Charlie was already flying in the right direction, toward the North Sea. He knew if he could get to the North Sea, he could get to England. But the fear was that if another German plane came along, game over. Charlie's bomber was shot to pieces so badly it couldn't defend itself. So Franz knew if he stayed there on Charlie's wing, no one would try to molest this American bomber. No other German fighter plane, no German guns on the ground. They wouldn't shoot at him. So Franz stayed there. And at first he tried a couple things. He pointed to the ground. And he was trying to say, "Land in Germany, land in Germany. You're never going to make it across the sea." And Charlie just looked confused, shook his head. He didn't quite get it. Then, as they flew a little further, Franz pointed to Sweden, and he was saying, "Sweden, Sweden, go to Sweden." Now, of course, they're just communicating between the cold, thin air between them. And Charlie can't hear him. He doesn't know what he's saying. And Charlie shakes his head again. And that's when Franz says, "Oh, boy, I've done everything I can. Good luck, you're in God's hands." And he just stays with him. And that's it.
And they fly to safety.
They do. They go out over the North Sea. Charlie becomes unnerved after a while. He has a German fighter plane, the world's worst nightmare, on his right wing. And eventually he says to one of his gunners, "Get up in your turret and turn your guns toward this guy and chase him away. I don't know what he wants with us, but I don't like him." Franz sees the guns start to turn. He salutes Charlie and he says, "Good luck, you're in God's hands." And he peels off and he flies back to Germany. The encounter's over, and it only lasted 10 minutes.
And Charlie Brown, I mean, every time I hear his name, one smiles because one thinks of the comic strip Peanuts, but this was a true Charlie Brown.
It was the original Charlie Brown. And just like the Peanuts character, I hate to make this parallel, but Charlie was a really good guy. You know, he's a farm kid from West Virginia, like you said. He grew up very poor. He cared for his father because he lost his mother at a very early age, and his father fell into a deep depression. So Charlie almost became the father of his family. So he cared for his father, poor as can be. He used to work as a janitor after school at the local elementary school. And in the mornings, he would milk the cows. So he was a hard worker, came from nothing. And then World War II comes, and due to his talent and aptitude and love of country, he becomes a B-17 pilot. So he goes from farm boy and janitor to captain of a four-engine bomber with nine men's lives in his hands.
And this was his first flight?
It was his first mission with his whole crew.
Wow. And the crew must have looked at this young man and thought, whose hands are we in?
He was just 21 years old. Now, he told the crew that he was older than that. He said, I'm 24.
Huh.
And he did that so they wouldn't worry because he was just this fresh-faced kid. He had a very square face, very worrisome-looking eyes, very shy eyes. But he was just a simple, good person, and they respected him.
Adam Makos, his new book is titled A Higher Call, An Incredible True Story of Combat and Chivalry in the War-Torn Skies of World War II. Do join us. I look forward to hearing from you. Adam Makos is here with me. He's telling us the story, an incredible but true story, of an incident that occurred during World War II. He's written a new book. It's titled A Higher Call. If you'd like to join us, call us 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. You've told us about Charlie Brown. Tell us about Franz Stigler. He was the German pilot who ultimately saved this American pilot flying the B-17 and his crew.
The book has these two heroes. So you've got the American hero and the German hero. And it's a very unusual war story in that you very seldom, if ever, see the war from both sides. So that's I'm so grateful to have found these two men and interview them. Franz is the hero we follow before Charlie in the book because Franz went to war earlier than Charlie did. Franz grew up a young boy who loved to fly gliders in southern Germany. He flew with his older brother, and that was their passion. Now, his mother wanted him to become a priest. She had her own designs for him. And Franz faced this this turning point where a priest said to him, Franz, follow your heart. You only have to answer to God, and your mother will get over it. Do what you want to do. And Franz said, I want to be a pilot. And the priest said, go do it then. So that idea of you only have to answer to a higher call, a higher power, it's important. The seed was planted when he was young. So Franz becomes an airline pilot. He's enjoying his life, and suddenly World War II breaks out. One day, the German Air Force shows up, and they say, hey, guess what? You're flying for us now. In Germany in World War II, you didn't say no. When the whole country went to war and everyone was drafted, everyone went to war. There was no hiding out from that.
How did Franz Stigler feel about the Nazis?
He was deeply opposed to them. His family, they were a Bavarian Catholic family. And when Hitler came to power, when the Nazis really took power in 1933, his family had voted against them. And much of Germany had voted against them. And that's something that not many people know about. There were good Germans. When the Nazis essentially won the election to take power, they won with 44% of the vote. That means 56% of the country were like Franz's family. They voted for parties other than the National Socialists. So there were a lot of good Germans in the last election that Germany had. After that, Hitler came to power, abolished elections, abolished political parties, took over the media and every facet of life. And at the time, Franz was just a 17-year-old boy, so he wasn't following politics. But he knew enough. He knew what his parents believed. He knew what his neighbors believed. And he was apathetic at first and then anti-Nazi as he grew up.
But nevertheless, drafted, if you will, to fly for the Nazis.
Exactly. He was made a flight instructor first. So he's training young pilots to go off to war because, again, Franz doesn't want to get into the fighting. One day, a new student comes into his classroom. It's his older brother, August. And his brother said, listen, everybody's getting drafted. I decided I'd rather fly than walk in the mud or fight in the trenches. So I became a pilot. And Franz said, why did you do this? This is a mistake. Franz trains his brother as passionately as he can. He goes above and beyond to make sure his brother will survive the war. His brother August goes off to war and is immediately killed.
Ugh.
So it's devastating because that was Franz's life. So now the Germans, the Nazis, have taken his brother. But Franz succumbs in a strange way. He succumbs to that human emotion, the universal emotion. He wants revenge. So he says, I'm tired of being a flight instructor. They just killed my brother. I want to be a fighter pilot.
So he ends up in Northern Africa, and the Germans are fighting the British there. What did this experience mean for him?
This experience was a great wake-up call for Franz. He goes to the desert eager for revenge. And before his first mission, his commanding officer sits him down on the wheel of his plane, a man named Rodel. And Rodel says, Franz, first of all, the rules are different in the desert. We fight with chivalry. We fight with honor. The desert was almost like an extension of World War I. The British pilots and the German pilots fought each other with a great deal of civility. And, it was the idea of chivalry. It was still alive then. And it died as World War II went on. As the war became more virulent and uglier, it the idea of chivalry died. But before that first mission, Rodel said, Franz, what are you going to do if you shoot down a plane and you find a man in a parachute? And Franz said, sir, I haven't thought that far ahead. And Rodel said, well, I'm going to tell you how things are going to be. If I ever hear or see you shoot a man in a parachute, I will shoot you down myself. And the words just stung Franz, because here he's already nervous, and now his commanding officer is saying, I'm going to shoot you if you even consider this. And then Rodel said, now listen, son. He puts a hand on Franz's shoulder, and he says, you fight by the rules of war for yourself, not for your enemy. You fight by the rules of war so you can keep your soul. And the rules are what separates men from animals. So Rodel was thinking, Franz, if you survive this war, I want you to be able to have a clean conscience for the rest of your life. And that wisdom changed Franz, and we watch him change.
This incident, which you described earlier, once Charlie Brown gets back to safety, does he report it directly to his commanding officer?
He does. Charlie, it's a harrowing mission, his journey across the North Sea, because his plane is down to two engines are essentially functioning. The other two are knocked out. So he barely makes it to England, barely lands. And his crews just survive this harrowing mission where they've almost all been killed, and then they've been rescued by this German fighter pilot. And he sits down for a debriefing. They did this after every mission. And the debriefing officer, a man named Harper, gives him a shot of scotch to loosen the wheels, I guess you could say. And Charlie tells him, okay, here's what happened to us. We were hit over the target. We were attacked by 15 enemy fighters. One of my men was killed. Four were wounded. We fell out of the sky. We're flying home. And then this German fighter pilot shows up and flies alongside of us. And the interrogation officer, Harper, says, wait, stop. A German flies alongside of you? And then Charlie describes in great detail what this unknown German did. It was a mystery to him. Nobody knew why he did it. But then Harper said, Charlie, I think you're going to get a lot of medals for this. This is incredible. Your crew, I'm passing this up to headquarters right now. So he sends Charlie off. He says, go get a sandwich in the officers' club and we'll talk. So Charlie goes and he tells his crew, hey, we're all going to get medals, it sounds like. Half hour later, Harper comes up and he says, Charlie, we've got a big problem here. The brass has said, keep a lid on this thing. No medals are coming to your crew, and if you guys utter a word of this, you're going to face a court-martial.
And the question is, why?
Charlie is shocked. He's just survived December 20th, the worst day in his life, and now he's being told that there's going to be a cover-up, essentially. And the reason is, the Americans didn't want, the 8th Air Force didn't want the story of a chivalrous German flyer to escape because another bomber's gunners might see a German come up slow and fly up toward their wing, and they didn't want anyone holding their fire for even a second, thinking that some German wanted to fly with them or escort them. Or they wanted our guys to see the enemy as monsters. It was war. That was their job. And so Charlie took it in stride. He said, all right, I'm not happy with it, but I'll live with it. And the man said, good, that's what you came here to do. You're a bomber pilot. I want you to go back and bomb Germany again and again and again until this war's over.
And what about Franz when he returns to his base?
Franz returns to his base and he doesn't utter a word of this incident. If he told anyone, he would be taken outside and shot. I don't even know if they would have taken him outside. They would have just shot him. Because in those days, you could be shot or killed by the guillotine, as many German civilians were, for speaking out against the Nazi Party, for telling a joke against Hitler, let alone escorting an enemy bomber out of Germany to allow it to come back and bomb German cities and perhaps kill German people again and again and again. It was an act of treason, but as Franz saw it, it was an act of saving his soul and honoring his humanity.
His rosary, Franz's rosary, present in that reading that you gave us, and the statement that had been made to him, shooting a man in a parachute, he saw a parallel between that statement and this wounded plane.
Exactly. He had the background of faith that he had grown up with. So he knew he was accountable to God, and he knew God was watching. And so that was in his mind. And then when he saw the plane defenseless, that's when the parachute analogy hit him. And he said, this will be no victory for me. I will not have this on my conscience for the rest of my life. And he chose his humanity over his nationality.
You know, it's just fascinating when we think about the utter brutality that exists not only in war, but even around us as we live today, to think about this moment, this 10 minutes in these two men's lives and your pursuit thereof. So what happens to Charlie after the war?
After the war, Charlie stays in the U.S. Air Force, builds a career out of it, and lives a happy life, moves to Miami, Florida, raises a family. Now, Charlie in the latter years is haunted still by this memory of this German. It never leaves him. And he's out of reunion of his pilot class. And the men are sitting around the hospitality room drinking and swapping stories. And one of them, a man named Joe Jackson, said, "Charlie, what's the most amazing thing that happened to you in the war?" And Charlie smiles. He said, "Well, Joe, you know, one time I was saluted by a German fighter pilot." And all the men started laughing. And Joe said, "All right, tell that one." And Charlie told it. And everybody was spellbound. They'd never heard of such a thing. And then Joe said something very important. He said, "Charlie, that man may still be alive. It's 1985. He may be out there. You should try to find him." And Charlie said, "Wow, okay, it's a big world. I don't know the German's name. We never exchanged a word. We just flew beside each other in silence. How am I ever going to do this?" And he began to search the world. And
how in the world could he have found him?
At first, he tried the official route. So he went to archives, and he would look for records. Oh, can I find the pilots who were flying at that place at that time? And so many of the records from World War II were either destroyed in bombings. They were useless. Then he found a stat that said there were 40,000 German fighter pilots in World War II, and only 2,000 survived. So Charlie was a bit crestfallen. He said, "He's likely dead." And still, though, he had that lingering question. Who was this man, and why did he save my life? So he kept looking. Finally, he put an ad in a magazine for retired German pilots. And at his home in Vancouver, Canada, Franz Stiegler wandered out to his mailbox, found his newsletter. It was 1990, January, when he opened it up and saw this ad, "Looking for the German pilot who spared my life on December 20th, 1943, north of Bremen, Germany. If you know the details, contact me, Charlie Brown." Franz sat down, penned the letter, and history was made.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. So how did Franz feel about being found by Charlie Brown?
Franz was incredibly relieved. He needed this to heal as much as Charlie did, because Franz had wondered for 47 years since the war. He had wondered, was it worth it? Was the risk I took worth it? And did they survive? When he said goodbye to that American bomber, he didn't know if it was going to make it across the ocean. He didn't know if those men all met a watery grave or not, or if they came home and they lived good lives and they raised families. So it mattered to him. So when he saw that, he wrote Charlie a letter and he said, "Charlie, I'm just glad it was worth it." He said, "Maybe someday we can meet." Charlie got this letter and the tears started flowing, and he told his wife, "This could be him. This could be him." But he didn't know. Charlie was skeptical. He said, "What are the odds that this man, I have to vet him." So instead of writing him a letter, Charlie picked up the phone and he said, "I'm going to call the Vancouver operator," and he got a hold of Franz Stiegler. So they have this awkward first conversation. And Charlie says, "Okay, so Mr. Stiegler, you claim you saved my life over northern Germany?" "Yeah, yeah, yeah." And they start talking about it. Charlie says, "All right, I've got a question for you. I've held back some information. I didn't put this in the ad. The German who saved my life, where did you say goodbye to us? Where were we when we said goodbye?" Because Charlie had only ever advertised it happened over northern Germany.
Right.
And Franz said, "Well, I took you out over the ocean. I saluted you and flew away." And that's when Charlie said, "My God, it's you." And then they both start crying on the phone, and they both say, we must meet. We must meet.
And they finally do meet on June 21st, 1990 in Seattle. The reunion is videotaped. I want you, our listeners, to hear this first clip.
It's hard to describe. If you see an airplane that's so crippled, you know positively that there were badly wounded people aboard. And for me, it would have been the same as shooting at a parachute. I just couldn't shoot. That's all there is. I just hoped that he brought his wounded man home.
And there is that line. It would have been like shooting a man on a parachute.
Exactly. You see their faces in this video clip. You hear their voices. And this overwhelming sense of truth comes through. It takes you back. You see the strange love that these two men have for each other, even though they're all but strangers, because that bond that was formed in 1943 on December 20th stayed with them their whole lives. And Charlie described Franz as being like a brother he hadn't seen in 40 years.
And how old are they when they finally meet?
They're in their very late 80s.
Late 80s. Adam Akos, he's the author of a new book. It's titled A Higher Call. We'll take a short break and come back for your calls. I look forward to speaking with you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children both in and out of school, at wallacefoundation.org. By T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at troweprice.com. And by the Cy Sims Foundation, supporter of the Cy Sims School of Business at Yeshiva University at cysimsfoundation.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, the history of how assault weapons like the semi-automatic rifle that was used in the Newtown Massacre became available on the civilian market. We talk with Tom Diaz, senior policy analyst at the Violence Policy Center and author of the forthcoming book, The Last Gun. Join us.
And if you just joined us, Adam Makos is with me. He's written this extraordinary story of two men who met during World War II, two pilots, one American, one German. The German assisted the American pilot, who was in an extraordinarily wounded plane with one wounded man on board, to safety. His new book is titled A Higher Call. We do have a video of the two men on our website at drshow.org. I'm going to open the phones now, 800-433-8850. Let's go first to Oklahoma City. Good morning, Joseph. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane, and the happiest of holidays to everybody out there.
Thank you so much.
Adam, first of all, thank you for writing this book. As an historian and history professor, I know that we lose about 1,400 World War II veterans a day, and those are stories that will never we'll never get to hear or appreciate unless somebody like you writes a story. But I'm curious. I'm from West Virginia, and you had mentioned earlier that Captain Brown was from West Virginia as well. I'm curious if you could tell us from where in West Virginia he's from, and did you in fact have an opportunity to speak to his family when you were preparing all the information and evidence necessary for you to publish your book?
Thanks a lot, Joseph. I appreciate it. Charlie was from Weston, West Virginia, so I'm not sure if you know that spot. I guess it's a hilly, mountainous little country. Charlie went, and part of the book describes when he buzzed his old hometown. Right after he got his wings, he took the B-17 and he flew up the river in Weston and buzzed the town and blew the dust through the streets. And that was a great moment for a West Virginia farm boy. Charlie really was, I was so lucky. He was alive when I was working on this. We worked together for about 4 years, and he helped me in so many ways with the research. So, yes, his family was supportive of it, but I had Charlie, so I had the source, and I had Franz.
You had the source, and you had Franz as well. You traveled a great deal to write this book.
Yes, Diana. I was just 23 when I started it. And looking back, I say, wow, Adam, that's some good foresight. I don't even know how it came about. Some things are just meant to be. I think you have a calling, and one of my callings was just to write this book, to tell this story. It needed to be heard. And I had Franz and I had Charlie, so I flew to Vancouver and I flew to Miami, and I worked with them for 4 years, and that was the only way possible to get the amount of material we needed to write this.
Exactly. Let's go to Haslett, Michigan. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning. I wanted to make a comment that these kind of incidents were rare, but not all that uncommon. I read a book, I Boat Captain, and a Japanese sub had an American training sailing ship in its sights, you know, during the war. And they decided not to sink it. Instead, he signaled, beautiful ship, have a good voyage, and dove and left. Also, another sub captain had a hospital ship right in its sights. And he backed off once he realized that it was really a hospital ship, only to be reprimanded once he got back home.
That's interesting.
My feeling, Robert, I've read exactly what you're talking about. Happened on all fronts. It happened in many ways, and it answers in a way the question that this book poses: can good men be found on both sides of a bad war? And what you're saying is the exact proof, Franz Stiegler's proof. It happened probably more than we know.
To Joppatown, Maryland. Hi there, Mike.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you for taking my call.
Surely.
Thank you. It's interesting you were mentioning that story about the German pilot, because my uncle was a German pilot back then in those days, and he was shot down twice. He was shot down once over Italy and once over the Russian front. One of the stories that he told my father after the war had ended is how they had done a similar thing. He actually was flying the Messerschmitt 262, and apparently the story that I got, which is secondhand, is that he flew the next one of the American fighters, and you know, there's a lot of they're looking at each other. They were, you know, pretty tense, and my uncle just waved and flew off and went his own way, and the American pilot went his way. So it's you know, kind of very interesting. And you know, my mother, she's still alive, and she has all kinds of stories about the Second World War, what happened, you know, when she was in East Prussia, and you know, as a refugee, how they had to run away from the Russians, to when she went to Berlin, and the war ended in Berlin, and you know, all the you know, emotional stuff they had to experience at the end of the war back in those days.
Yeah, quite right. All these emotional stories.
Mm-hmm. Mike, there was that airmen shared a bond. It wasn't as ugly of a war as it was for the men on the ground. So they respected each other. So stories like this, I hear exactly what you're saying.
And to Madison, Connecticut. Hi, Ben.
Yes, good morning. Thank you very much for the show. I'm very pleased that you show the humanity of our enemies in this. I also have a similar story to the last caller. My father was a a German veteran who just recently passed away, and one of my uncles was a pilot who perished in the war. But it's nice to hear stories that depict these people as humans. And on the same vent, this other gentleman just called mentioned that his uncle was an ME-262 pilot. Some of the heroes that we hold up in high regard, Chuck Yeager, for example, towards the end of the war, the ME-262 was impossible to catch in the air, and the only way you were able to register a kill was to shoot a plane down when it was either taking off or landing. And this was often done. The airdromes where they took off from were being circled by Allied fighters, and it was little more than execution. And we rewarded people with medals and honors for doing this.
Ben, you're 100% right. The book, this is kind of exciting. It follows Franz throughout the war. So we see what happened to him after December 20th and how he suffered. But in the end of the war, he was a jet pilot, a ME-262 pilot, just like you described. He was convinced to stay in the war by a little girl. And that's a whole story in itself. He visited a bombed-out city, met a little girl, and this little girl would one day become his wife. There was about 15 years difference between them. I'm not going to spoil it. You can read the book. But this little girl convinced Franz to stay in the cockpit and to keep flying until the day the bomb stopped falling. So Franz said, all right, I'll do that. And he became a jet pilot. He flew in the jets. And he was on that firing line you're describing, almost an execution, because at the end of the war, the Allies had such air superiority that they killed off the German fighter pilots one by one by one. And Franz ends up being one of the last men standing.
Wow. Here's, I want to hear Charlie's voice because it's so human.
I look out the right window, and there parked on my right wing is a German BF-109. Just as the little sucker looked like he owned me and belonged there. And I was still in a little bit of a state of shock. And so I sort of closed my eyes and shook my head as you would with a nightmare. And if I close my eyes and open them again, he'll be gone. Well, I opened them again, and he was still there.
What a guy.
What a guy, and what a video. Again, for Joe Jackson to have the foresight to film Franz and Charlie on the day of their reunion, June 1990, and to put them both in their seats and to say, Franz, how do you feel about meeting Charlie? Charlie, how do you feel about meeting Franz? It's incredible film, and it's on your website. And I'm just so glad people can appreciate that. And they can see these two men. They can see their eyes.
Tell me about Joe Jackson.
Joe Jackson was a Medal of Honor recipient himself from the Vietnam War, good friend of Charlie. So when Charlie went to reunite with Franz, he said, Joe, this is going to be an emotional darn thing. You want to come with me? And Joe said, I'd love to. And he brought his video camera. And somehow that video survived the years, and Joe gave it to us, and we gave it to you, Diane. So it's on your website.
Help me to understand just how long the Allies wanted to keep this secret.
The Allies kept, they told Charlie, essentially, never talk about
exactly.
your story again. And he did. He honored that, and for 40-some years, he didn't talk about it. Now, an amazing thing happened. In 1943, of course, the 8th Air Force said, no awards for you and your crew. Never utter this again. In 2008, a beautiful thing happened. Not only did Charlie and Franz find each other, not only did they get along great and become brothers, they called each other brothers, but the U.S. Air Force called Charlie down to the Florida State Capitol, and they said, we were wrong 40-some years ago, 50 years ago. Here is the Air Force Cross, the second highest award for valor in the American military. And each of your men is going to have a silver star. Even though they're all dead, except for one, they all get silver stars. So in the end, Charlie's bravery was recognized. Now, Franz never got a medal. He never was recognized. But Franz got something else, and I'll tell you about it. I found a book in Charlie's library. I wasn't supposed to find it. He just said, Adam, there's my library. Go do whatever you want. And the book had an inscription, the most haunting words I've ever read. And this was how Franz felt. It said, Franz gave this book to Charlie. It was about a jet fighter he flew. Franz wrote, in 1940, I lost my only brother as a night fighter. On the 20th of December, 4 days before Christmas, I had the chance to save a B-17 from her destruction. A plane so badly damaged, it was a wonder that she was still flying. The pilot, Charlie Brown, is for me as precious as my brother was. Thanks, Charlie. Your brother, Franz.
That just takes your breath away.
It knocked me out when I was there.
And you say you weren't supposed to find it, and yet you did when you showed it to Charlie. What did he say?
He said, "That's Franz."
That's Franz. Let's hear Franz and Charlie talking with each other.
Could you sort of tell us what your feelings were when you two met today?
It's almost impossible to describe. We had spent several hours on the phone, so I felt that we had something in common, first a love of air and a love of aviation. It was like meeting a family member, a brother that you haven't seen for 40 years. That's about as close as I can come.
Franz, what were your feelings when you met again for the first time?
I was so happy as we met that I dropped him on top of him. Wasn't easy.
He's fighting back his tears.
And the next line, which people will have to go to your website now to hear it and to see it, the next line is, "I love you, Charlie." And the camera just keeps rolling, and everything goes silent. And slowly the camera swings over to Charlie, and he doesn't even know what to say.
I'll say you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's take a caller in St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Judy.
Oh, good morning. I wanted to say that today is my mom and dad's 71st wedding anniversary.
Wow. Yes. Yesterday was my 53rd wedding anniversary. Thank you.
Well, and my dad was trained as a navigator during World War II, although the war ended before he had to go. But I am going straight to Amazon right now to buy Adam's book and hope I can get it for them before Christmas.
Oh, what a wonderful gift that will be.
Well, I'm delighted to have had this coincidence happen on their very day. And thank you very much for letting me talk to Adam.
Thank you for calling.
Thank you, Judy. And please do select that two-day shipping or whatever, because it's getting close to Christmas.
And I'm totally quite right. All right. And finally, to Kathleen in Naples, Florida. Thanks for waiting.
Oh, sure. Hi, Diane.
Hi.
And to your guests, and Merry Christmas.
Merry
Happy
Christmas.
New Year.
Thank you.
The first couple of moments that I heard this show, I couldn't believe it. Both my husband and I had chills running down our spine because my father was a navigator by the stars during World War II. He was B-17, of course, a flight crew, and it was the 463rd Bombardment Group. They were actually called the Swoosh Group. And to make a very long story short, he and his crew were flying over the Mediterranean. They got shot down. The entire plane went down into the water. Miraculously, I don't remember the details, the entire crew actually made it to the mainland but were captured. And the German soldiers that actually captured them, my dad, by the way, broke 5 ribs, was in a tremendous amount of pain. I don't even know how he swam to shore, to be honest with you. My dad also is Polish, and he grew up learning Polish as a child. And somehow, after they were captured, he actually managed to speak Polish to the soldiers. One of them took compassion and sympathy and let them go.
Incredible. And yet again, it reaffirms that premise. Good men can be found on both sides of a bad war. And that's why I'm so proud of Franz and Charlie. They're new heroes for these dark ages, these dark days, I should say.
And for you, Adam, how does this book, how does working on it, writing it, meeting these two men who have now gone, how does it affect you?
Meeting these two men changed my life. It changed the way I look at World War II. It changed the way I look at the person I call the enemy. It teaches you to think twice, to honor your humanity first, not just your first inclination. And learning, if you see two enemies hug and cry, and as we see Franz do, say, I love you, then why can't we build a better world?
Adam Makos, his new book is titled A Higher Call, an incredible true story of combat and chivalry in the war-torn skies of World War II. Thank you for the gift you've given to all of us.
Thanks for the honor, Diane.
Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Raymond.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations.